KTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. Now 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. June is Pride Month, and June 2021 marks a sad anniversary, the 40th anniversary of the first cases of AIDS reported here in the United States. AIDS, or acquired immune deficiency syndrome, is still with us, still killing people all over the world. And it is estimated that perhaps 35 million deaths have been caused by AIDS since the disease was first identified in the early 1980s. On today's morning show, we're going to be hearing two different interviews about the massive AIDS memorial quilt, which by now consists of nearly 50,000 memorial panels designed to honor the memory of those who have died from AIDS. Later in the hour, we'll hear from John Cunningham, current chief executive of the National AIDS Memorial. But first, from the archives comes a 2012 conversation with Cleve Jones, the AIDS activist who conceived of the idea of the quilt and helped bring it into being. The occasion of my conversation with Cleve Jones was an event at UW Parkside to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the quilt, in which a number of panels from it were displayed in the school's art gallery. Cleve Jones began our interview by looking back at those terrifying days in the early 1980s.
I'm speaking to you today from my apartment in San Francisco's Castro neighborhood. I live right near the intersection of Castro and Market Streets, and by 1985, 1,000 of my immediate neighbors had already been killed by the new disease, and for those of us who were living here, it was really like being in a battle zone. The death toll was just staggering and continued unabated for over 10 years. We were losing between 2,000 and 3,000 people a year just in this one compact neighborhood in the middle of San Francisco. So really everybody in our city was affected, and almost everybody did absolutely everything they could to fight back. But the idea of the quilt is actually in a way connected to the story of Harvey Milk, who was my mentor young man when I first got to San Francisco. Every year on November 27th, we reenact the Candlelight March that occurred on November 27th, 1978, when he was assassinated with our mayor, George Moscone. And in 1985, as people were gathering for the annual Candlelight Tribute, I had stacks of poster board and stacks of magic markers, and I asked everybody to write down the names of their neighbors and friends and lovers who had been killed by the new disease. And at first, people were ashamed to do it. The stigma associated with the disease was so overwhelming at that time. It's still bad, but it was much worse then. And we carried these names down to the old federal building, and I had ladders hidden in the shrubbery, and people climbed up, and we taped the walls, these placards to the walls of the federal building. And it was as I looked at that odd patchwork sort of names that I said to myself, it looks like some kind of strange quilt. And I don't know about if your listeners would agree, but when I say the word quilt, I think of my grandmother. I think of my great-grandmother. I think of the Conestoga wagons crossing the prairie. And it was such a warm and comforting and middle-class and middle-American and traditional family values sort of symbol. And I thought, oh, that's just what we need. Mm. And other people understood pretty quickly. At first, it was hard to explain before I had some quilts made because people couldn't see it in their heads as clearly as I could. But it took off very rapidly, and all sorts of people made it their own project and made it happen.
Mm. I am anxious to ask you more about the quilt. Ahead of talking more about it, I would actually like to know more about those days in San Francisco. In fact, even beginning before the onset of the AIDS epidemic, you began your work as an activist. I know they're in the 70s, and at some point, I assume fairly early on, were befriended by Harvey Milk and became an intern in his office. Could you just tell us about the work that you were doing in the office of Harvey Milk and what those days felt like, again, before the onset of the AIDS epidemic?
Sure. I hitchhiked up to San Francisco in early 1973 from Phoenix, Arizona. And I had been already quite political, even in high school. Those were the days of the Vietnam War, and I and almost all of my friends were involved in the anti-war movement, and Cesar Chavez had come to Arizona to organize the Great Workers, and we supported that struggle as well. So when I got to San Francisco, it was just really the very beginning of this enormous gay migration that occurred, where I think at its peak, probably 100 gay people a day were arriving on buses from all over the country just to find a place where they could feel some sense of freedom and community. So I was very fortunate to be part of that first wave here. And, you know, it was an extraordinary time. And I think back then, I always, what I remember is just how aware we all were that what we were participating in had never been seen before. And so there was a great deal of excitement about it. It was a very romantic time, very kind of revolutionary time. And part of the one of the outcomes of that enormous migration into the neighborhood was the election of Harvey Milk to our Board of Supervisors, which is the equivalent of a city council. And he was not the first openly gay man elected to public office, but he was the first in California and one of the first six people nationwide to be elected to hold public office as openly gay or lesbian people. He was very charismatic and fun. I always also feel important to note that he was neither a genius nor a saint, and his life was often in disarray. He experienced many of the challenges and setbacks and defeats that most people experience. So I always want, especially young people, to know that his achievements are ones that we can all aspire to. Mm-hmm. I was kind of a brat and a street kid in some sense, and he encouraged me to go to school and to cut my hair and to come and work with him as a student intern for credit from San Francisco State when he took office in January of 1979. And we worked on all sorts of issues. We were fighting the Briggs Initiative, which was an attempt to make it illegal for gay people to work in the school districts. We were able to defeat that. We were also working on things like getting stop signs put in at dangerous intersections and finding funding for senior programs and mental health programs for the Latino community, a whole range of issues. It was a wonderful experience for a kid. It only lasted 11 months before he was shot.
Wow. I think some of our listeners perhaps have seen that the extraordinary documentary about Harvey Milk's career as an activist and in public office, and then that shocking assassination of him and of the mayor of San Francisco, and that chilling footage of Dianne Feinstein announcing essentially to the public for the first time that the two of them had been killed. And in the wake of that, unbelievable shock and horror and sorrow, and also that extraordinary image that I think many of us, even just seeing it on film, will never forget of the first of many candlelight vigils in which one saw in tangible fashion just how much sorrow and how much love was held by the so many in San Francisco for their fallen mayor and especially for Harvey Milk. Can you just say a word about the aftermath of that double assassination and what it felt like to try to go on in the wake of such a shock?
I was in City Hall that day, and I returned to the office. I'd been running in some errands, and I remember when I came around the corner and saw his body, the first thing that went through my mind was, it's over. He was my mentor and sort of a father figure to me. He was very kind to me. He was also our leader. And it was a new movement. It was a movement that was just really taking its first baby steps forward. And we were kind of trapped in City Hall that afternoon while they bundled up the bodies, you know, and we had to wait there. And I just kept thinking, it's over, and it's over, it's over. And then we got back to the neighborhood, and the sun went down, and all different kinds of people began gathering. There were gay people, of course, but there were people from every neighborhood and every background and race and faith who came to the corner of Castro and Market and lit their candles and marched in absolute silence down Market Street. And when you see the footage and the documentary that you were referring to, The Times of Harvey Milk by Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman, or when you watch the feature film Milk, directed by Gus Van Sant and written by Dustin Lance Black, you see these images. And I always tell young people, you know, when they're watching Milk, that those aren't computer-generated graphics there. That's what it looked like. And I think that in those first days of following the murders, while we were very much in grief and shock, I think there was a real clear understanding that we would survive this and we would move forward. And those days were so, you know, very, I mean, it was really a crazy time in San Francisco. And then in the spring, in May, the verdict came out, and somehow in our amazingly diverse city, they had managed to impanel a jury that was all white and all heterosexual, and gave Dan White, the murderer, a very light sentence. He was convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to just 7 years, of which he would serve only five. And you know, when the word got out, there was a horrendous riot here, and thousands of people stormed City Hall and burned police cars in Civic Center Plaza. So it was very tense. It was very frightening. But out of it came some real changes. And one of the most significant changes was in the police force, which now is very diverse. In those days, the police force was almost entirely white men of Irish or Italian Catholic descent, and very few minorities, very, very few women, no gay people, no openly gay people. And that's really changed. I think our police department comes much more close to reflecting the diversity of San Francisco now. And that is largely as a consequence of those years. Another thing that happened was that the gay community became solidified as a political entity. And the efforts that Harvey had pioneered to get what had started out to be the gay liberation movement to adopt more traditional tactics, including some really old school, you know, precinct by precinct operations, which were replicated all across the country. And so in virtually every metropolitan area now, we see a very clearly defined gay neighborhood that provides a sense of community to people, but also contributes to political power, because it is in those gay communities where we are able to do the precinct by precinct work that gets our own people elected and people who support our gay agenda.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Cleve Jones. Cleve Jones, at some point, of course, what enters the picture is something that could not possibly have been anticipated, namely this mysterious and deadly virus, which, of course, began striking down particularly gay men in increasingly alarming numbers. I wonder if you can recall your very first experience in which this began to occur. I mean, do you have a recollection of the first person you knew, for instance, who had fallen victim to this strange new disease?
I first became aware of the new disease in June of 1981. At that point, I was working as a consultant to the California State Assembly, and I was assigned to the Health Committee, so I had to look at all the legislation that was coming through related to health, and also keep up to date on public health issues. So I subscribed to any number of journals and magazines and such, and one of them was the report from the weekly bulletin from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. And it was there that I read the first, they were the first, I think, three paragraphs printed about what we now call HIV. And it described these clusters of gay men in L.A. and New York who had a very aggressive form of pneumonia called pneumocystis and a strange skin cancer called Kaposi's sarcoma. Shortly after that, I was contacted by a local physician, a dermatologist at the University of California, San Francisco, named Marcus Conant, who would be one of the great heroes of the global effort to fight back against HIV, and he took me up to UCSF and introduced me to a young man named Simon Guzman, who was already near death and died a few days later. But within 1 year, my friends began to get sick, and by 1985, when the death toll here hit 1,000, almost everyone I knew personally was sick or dying or dead or caring for someone who was dying. It was overwhelming. Most of us were very young. Many of us had never even experienced the death of a loved one before, because most of us in the neighborhood were under 30. And it was very, very hard.
Hmm. Tell us about the founding in 1983 of the San Francisco AIDS Foundation.
Well, Marcus Conant, Dr. Conant, got together with Dr. Paul Volberding from San Francisco General Hospital, and a few local business people from the gay community and the publisher of our local gay weekly newspaper, and I. We got together and we started what was then at first called the Kaposi Sarcoma Research and Education Foundation, because it was before the word AIDS had been coined. And you know, we didn't have a lot of information, but we were trying to get the word out. Marcus Conant correctly made the assumption that it was sexually transmitted with a long latency period. So we just started early on trying to get people to modify their behavior and then to create the services to care for the people who were dying. We had thousands and thousands of people who could not take care of themselves, who needed housing, who needed food, who needed medical care. And it was during a time when there were no treatments available whatsoever. When the antibody test came out in 1985, and I myself tested positive that first month that testing began. And, you know, I had to live with the knowledge that I had the virus for a full 10 years before any kind of effective treatment became available. And so for me, in my own personal struggle and also in the larger political struggle, the most important thing was just to keep hope in people's hearts so that they wouldn't give up, and to just do everything we could to help people be strong so that they could be here when eventually a cure would be found. Now, we still don't have a cure, regrettably, nor do we have a vaccine, nor do we see any real progress in either of those efforts. But we do have very effective treatments now that are easy to take and have very few side effects and can keep people alive for a normal lifespan if they have access to the medication. And I'm sure most of your listeners are well aware that there are vast regions of this planet where millions of people are infected and have no access to these medications. So we need to do everything we can to make sure that every person on this planet with HIV has access to the same medications that have kept me alive and productive and working full-time and then some for all these years. And I think there's another important part of this that your listeners may not be aware of, which is that in the last year, we've seen a number of studies that have proven quite conclusively what many frontline physicians and activists have been speculating about for a long time, which is the fact now that people like myself who are being successfully treated for HIV, the viral load within our bloodstream is reduced so dramatically that we're really no longer capable of transmitting the virus. This does not mean that people should, you know, take risk, but we need everybody to, you know, play safe always. But it's an important piece of information, especially in the absence of progress towards a cure or a vaccine. The rallying cry of the militant activists during the early years of the epidemic was silence equals death. I think the slogan for these days should be that treatment equals prevention. So what we do know is that there is hope to really reduce the disease, to create a generation free of HIV, to stop the birth of children with HIV from infected mothers, if we can get these treatments accessible to everyone. So I had the incredible privilege and honor of meeting with President Obama in the White House earlier this year, and I said to him that the single most important thing we can do now is eliminate all remaining barriers to accessing medication for people with HIV everywhere. And that's a daunting task, but I am confident that we can do it.
We're speaking with Cleve Jones. Mr. Jones, could I ask you a couple more questions quickly about the AIDS Memorial Quilt?
Yeah.
I know you're busy. I appreciate this opportunity. You have already told us the moment in which you received kind of the initial inspiration for the creation of something like a quilt by which to memorialize those who had already fallen, at least some of those who had already fallen. And by that point in time, we're talking about many thousands of people who had already perished from AIDS.
Yes.
Tell us what you envisioned. I mean, did you imagine anything like what the AIDS Memorial Quilt has come to be? I mean, in your mind, what did you foresee, and how divergent is that from what, in fact, the AIDS Memorial Quilt has come to, in fact, be?
Well, I think some of your listeners may not believe it, but I saw it in my head. I just saw the National Mall in Washington, D.C., covered from the steps of the Capitol to the Washington Monument with brightly colored squares of fabric. I had this picture in my head of people, all different kinds of Americans, sitting on their living room floors or church and synagogue basements, sharing stories and working with thread and fabric and magic markers and paints and glitter and whatever to tell the stories of their loved ones. I knew that the storytelling and working with their hands could help heal people, help ease the burden of grief that so many people were living under. I also believed it could be a great weapon, if you will, against the virus by using it to shame the politicians with the evidence of their inaction, by working with the media to put the heart and soul behind the statistics that were so mind-numbing at the time, and a way to just really illustrate the enormity of the crisis. So I saw it all in my head quite clearly, but nobody else did. And during that year, that first year, you know, most people told me that it was impossible or too expensive or too complicated. And I was already a fairly well-known activist in the community here, but with very few exceptions, everyone told me it was the stupidest thing that they'd ever heard of. So if there are any young people listening today who have a burning desire to do something, who know that they're called upon to do this one thing and everybody else tells them it's a really bad idea, then, you know, please ignore them and do it anyway.
Can you explain how, in fact, the project actually began, if there was that high a level of sort of bewilderment or cynicism or pessimism or whatever we're talking about here? But I mean, if in fact people by the thousands didn't immediately flock to this intriguing idea, if in fact scarcely anybody kind of saw the point of it or how it could happen, how in fact did it actually get off the ground then? I mean, what were sort of the nuts and bolts that allowed this to finally begin?
There were two or three people that showed up in my life who were determined to make it happen. One of them is still alive. Her name is Gert McMullen. She still works with the quilt in Atlanta. We made the first 40 or 50 quilt panels ourselves. And then at the end of June in 1987, our mayor at the time, Dianne Feinstein, gave us permission to hang these quilts from the balcony of the City Hall here in San Francisco. And people saw it and got it and understood and wanted to help. And by August, we had 1,920 panels. We displayed them on the mall. It's on the front page of every newspaper in the world. And then the quilts just began to pour in from all over.
AIDS activist Cleve Jones. This interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2012. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm so pleased that I can follow up on this archival conversation with Cleve Jones, with a conversation now with John Cunningham, who is chief executive of the National AIDS Memorial, and he has held that position since 2009. Mr. Cunningham, actually, for quite a number of years, had a professional career squarely in the commercial realm, working for several different Fortune 500 companies, but then for a number of reasons shifted his attention and his energies primarily into the nonprofit sector, and he has had very, very powerful impact there. And as I said, since 2009, he has been with the National AIDS Memorial. And so we are having this follow-up conversation with him to learn more about the history of the AIDS Memorial quilt and how it has, in a sense, found its way back to San Francisco, where the quilt actually had its beginning, its genesis. John Cunningham, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, it's great to be with you. Thank you so much for taking the time as we wind down Pride Month. So it's a great opportunity to sort of wind down in this way.
I appreciate it. And thank you for making time for this in your very, very busy schedule. I do want to, in this particular conversation, we'll have a follow-up conversation that will be heard in a few days. But I do want to focus particularly on this remarkable NAMES Project AIDS Memorial quilt, however we want to call it now, and get a sense of its history. That is, where this quilt has been, where its home has been, and we'll talk ultimately then about how it has found its way back to San Francisco and is part of an even greater memorial. But first, could you sketch for us kind of the history of the quilt itself once it was begun by Cleve Jones and others who believed in his vision?
You know, it's almost 35 years. Next year, it'll be 35 years since the quilt was the first thread was stitched to the quilt. You know, and it began, as Cleve, I believe, has shared, during a march memorializing Harvey Milk, who obviously was Cleve's mentor, and Cleve worked very closely with him, memorializing the assassination of Harvey Milk and Mayor Moscone in San Francisco and the tragedy that was. And at this particular march, there had been this new insidious disease or illness that had begun to befell the citizens in the community in San Francisco and the Castro district and the gay community most specifically. And Cleve, who organized the Candlelight Memorial March down from the Castro district several miles to Civic Center and the beauty of the majestic San Francisco City Hall with the dome, which is actually a taller dome than the dome in DC, and to the federal building where they were holding their gathering. And he had pulled up a bunch pieces of cardstock paper for people to write the names of people that perhaps they had lost recently over the last recent months, if you will, from this new mystery disease. And when he was completed with that, he put them on the side of the federal building, you know, as a statement that we must remember these names. We must remember these lost. And it was ironic. It was a Memorial Day, you know, memorializing the loss of Harvey Milk, but it was also now at this point memorializing the loss of these individuals. And when he stepped back, as the story goes, and I, you know, paraphrasing, or some of, I would never want to speak for Cleve, I'll let Cleve speak for himself, but he looked up and his grandmother had been a quilter. And he looked up and he saw these pieces of square, rectangular cardboard with names on them on the side of the building. And he said, it's a quilt. And that's sort of what was the genesis. That's sort of what started that vision at that time.
One thing that he said in his interview, my interview with him, that was so striking, and it would never have occurred to me unless he had said it, is the fact that a quilt is something that is such a homey, inviting sort of image, and something that a lot of ordinary people could really relate to. And of course, those who had died from AIDS could have been memorialized in any number of ways, including some ways that would have been extremely modern and flashy. And instead, Cleve Jones saw real value in memorializing them in a way that would be, in a sense, quite ordinary, but in, of course, in its scope and beauty became something quite extraordinary. But I thought that was an interesting insight that he shared there, that I think is part of what aided in the impact of the memorial quilt.
I think you're right. I think it, whether it was conscious or it was just serendipitous, it was genius. Quilting is quintessential Americana, and especially it's Americana in the Midwest and in parts of the South, where it's been passed down family history year after year. I mean, my husband and I have quilts from his family. One of them is the great star of Texas. It is quintessential Americana, and I believe in that sense it can speak to a community, to individuals, and open perhaps their hearts or at least their minds for a moment to see this powerful quilt that is part of the American culture, but that's different. And perhaps it can open some hearts and minds and get some conversations going. Because of course, in the original creation of the quilt, you know, it was created as a way, as an activist tool. Yes, it was memorializing, but it was an activist tool. You know, we had an administration that chose not to utter the word AIDS. We had a president, President Reagan, who fired his surgeon general who uttered the word AIDS, Dr. C. Everett Koop. And it was being stigmatized and was therefore those individuals that were being lost. When you can stigmatize or otherize things, it's so much easier to devalue those lives. Well, the quilt was going to show America that these are individual lives. These are human beings. And when it went on this first display to DC, it put our dead on the front lawn of America, i.e. the mall in DC. Here they are. Our dead are lying before you. You cannot ignore the fact that these are someone's brother, someone's son, someone's father. They are human beings, and they deserve our love and respect.
We're speaking with John Cunningham, Chief Executive of the National AIDS Memorial. Can you give us some sense, Mr. Cunningham, of just how rapidly the memorial quilt grew from its modest beginnings? It obviously began with one panel and then a handful of panels, but quickly grew to encompass thousands. Can you give us some sense of just how rapidly this quilt grew in size and scope?
And I'll share a little anecdotal story that Speaker Pelosi loves to share. But after that Memorial Day march and at the Federal Building and all of that, and Cleve had this great vision. He'd said, of a quilt. We're going to make a quilt to AIDS. And at that time, Nancy Pelosi was just a newly elected representative in Congress, because I think it's important that everybody remember as well that Nancy Pelosi ran for Congress on an AIDS platform. When she was sworn under that dome in the House of Representatives, they always say, welcome to the fair lady from San Francisco. Would you like to say anything? You're always told, be deferential to the speaker and say, no, I'm here and honored to speak. Well, of course, to Speaker Pelosi, or then Representative Pelosi, walked up to the microphone and said, I do have something to say. I'm here to give a voice to AIDS. I'm here to give a voice to those that have been lost. And I ask all of you here who represent districts, if you had lost 15,000 of your citizens, would you say we're doing enough? I think the answer is no. And I'm here to give a voice, and I will not stop until we may take action. So I say that because Cleve went to her home here in San Francisco with this harebrained idea of making a quilt. And he sat with her in her living room. And as she looked at him and said, Cleve, I am a Catholic schoolgirl. I've got 5 children. I can sew, I can darn, I can macrame, I can crochet, I can knit, I can do all those things, but I don't sew. People don't sew. No one's going to make a quilt. And so went the story. Well, within months after this started, and I think it's so important that all of your listeners remember, there was no internet. This was not being promoted online. There weren't e-blasts going out. This was word of mouth. And I think it speaks to the magnitude of loss that was happening in our nation and the lack of response that was going on from government and to public officials, the prejudice and discrimination that was happening out there in the field, and that people felt alone. They felt alone, and they felt that their loved ones were not being remembered. And so they began to sew, and they started sending these panels to the NAMES Project, to the AIDS Memorial Quilt here in San Francisco. And they started to arrive in bundles like they'd never imagined. I remember Cleve saying that the local post office called and said, you've got to get some people down here. There's packages in here filling up our post office. This doesn't work. Get down here and get these boxes. So it happened so quickly, and they sewed like their hearts were just, pounding so quickly. And I can remember living in the Castro at that time and going by where the quilt was being sewn and just hearing the hum of sewing machines in there going. So it happened rapidly. And then by the time they got to DC and they went to the first display, it was a significant display.
I remember seeing a large portion of the quilt in the Twin Cities, and one of my wife's dearest friends perished from AIDS in 1987, relatively early in the epidemic. It was east as far as Middle America was concerned. And I remember us desperately searching this wide expanse of the quilt, which wasn't even the entire quilt, and then so thrilled when we finally found Mitch's panel and could see it with our own eyes, but of course surrounded by all these other breathtakingly beautiful and moving panels. Give us some sense of where the quilt was and where the quilt is now, and sort of in what form or structure it is housed and preserved.
So, so the quilt was founded and created in San Francisco, much like the National AIDS Memorial that it is now part of, and I'll share some of that in a moment. They were both founded within years of each other and within miles of each other, both of them grassroots opportunities to memorialize and to remember and to share and to ensure that the lives lost would never be forgotten and the stories. So the quilt started, and for its first 10 years or so, 10, 15 years, was in San Francisco. And then for a number of reasons, but, really primarily for some financial reasons. The quilt, as I said, was an activist teaching tool. And oftentimes activists are not necessarily looking at it as to how something will sustain into the future. And so, it struggled financially for a period of time. And then when it left San Francisco, it was right at the time of .com in San Francisco, way back. Many of us remember .com. And it moved to Atlanta. And, it moved to Atlanta. A board member by the name of Julie Rode, who lived in Atlanta, courageously took the step forward and said, I will help the quilt to go to Atlanta. It went down to Atlanta with a fair amount of debt attached to it. And it also then started to do work in the South, because, of course, at that time and continuing today, the most adversely impacted communities are communities of color that have systemic barriers to positive health outcomes, internalized stigma and homophobia within those communities. And so it worked in the South out of Atlanta for a number of years, for almost 20 years. And again, it does for anybody that runs a nonprofit, when you're trying to dig yourself out of debt, it's tough to raise money because people don't want to give money to retire debt. But they did a good job. They got the debt down. Well, I was approached actually by Speaker Pelosi's chief of staff and former board member of ours at the National AIDS Memorial, Dan Bernal, and said, would you be open to having a conversation about assuming the quilt? And so we entered into a conversation. At the time, the National Center for Civil and Human Rights in Atlanta, which is John Lewis's baby, was looking at assuming the quilt because the quilt's board had made a strategic decision that it needed to find an institution that would be able to financially keep it going and help to sustain it into the future. And they just didn't see that the financial model they were operating under would. So anyway, so we began in conversations, and I'm forever indebted to Gilead Sciences for a couple of reasons. One, Gilead, who's a pharmaceutical manufacturer that has saved my life and so many others with their amazing treatments for HIV and AIDS. They stepped to the table with multi-million-dollar grant to us to help not only acquire the quilt, retire the debt, and then transfer the quilt from Atlanta back to San Francisco Bay Area to restabilize it. And it is now here. It arrived, actually, ironically, six different rail cars on different trains, because we never wanted the quilt to be on one train in the event there was a derail, that it wouldn't be in jeopardy. So you can imagine 52 tons, 50,000 panels, over 100,000 names of individuals lost, transferred from Atlanta back to the Bay Area. And it arrived and was lovingly shelved in a new state-of-the-art facility that we have by volunteers. And the last quilt was put on the shelves 2 weeks prior to the Bay Area being the first community in America going into lockdown last year. So it made it, thank God. I can't imagine if it had been halfway in route, what would have happened. Let's just put it this way. It would have been expensive to store it. So it is now these two iconic memorial projects, the National AIDS Memorial, which is a 10-acre memorial in Golden Gate Park, that was created as a grassroots organization, and then through an act of Congress written by Nancy Pelosi, is our nation's and only federally designated memorial to AIDS, and the quilt are now one. When we were at the Library of Congress and we did the handoff with John Lewis and Barbara Lee, who represents the East Bay District where the quilt is right now, and Nancy and Dr. Carla Hayden, the Librarian of Congress, I use the analogy, the quilt and the memorial, the AIDS memorial, are like two twins or siblings that parted their ways in their adolescent teens and went off into the world doing similar work, but have now come back together and joined together to continue to do the powerful work that needs to still happen around HIV and AIDS.
The occasion of my interview with Cleve Jones was when a portion of the quilt came to the area, to the University of Wisconsin right. Parkside, just right up the road from our station. And even a tiny little portion of the quilt was so moving and powerful to experience. Is that something that still occurs, or do people now see the quilt only in a sense, in virtual fashion?
Well, it's a great question, Greg. So last year, we tried our best, as many of us in our nation did, to try to turn lemons into lemonade wherever possible through the struggle and what we went through. You know, and I think it's important for those of us that lived through the AIDS crisis. You know, we lived through one pandemic and are still living through that pandemic, and let alone then another pandemic. And so last year, we went completely virtual online because we couldn't obviously send the quilt out because there were no gatherings of display. The quilt is right now, actually, just before I got on this call with you, we are putting together our promotion and outreach strategy and plan. The quilt is coming back to America, and we are looking at wanting the quilt to come to every single state in this country next year, this year, as we head towards World AIDS Day, actually. So the quilt is ready to go back out. We are prepared. There are orders coming in. So I hope that your local university nearby will do it again. I ask everybody that is interested in doing and bringing the quilt to their community to do so, because I think it more than ever, you know, the quilt delivered so much healing and comfort to communities that were so devastated by the AIDS crisis. You know, it brought to life the lives of those lost, but just by gathering with others who had gone through that loss, it magnified hope for a future. Well, the quilt can do the same for a nation that is coming out of COVID. By people gathering together and getting hope, gaining hope from those that went through the AIDS pandemic, and that they have survived and we have survived, and the work continues. So I encourage anybody that is interested in hosting a quilt display in your community, you can do so. And you can reach out to us at aidsmemorial.org. You can go to our website and learn more, and we're happy. We curate these displays. So as an example, let's say there's a community in the Pacific Northwest that's specifically focused on the native culture of the Pacific Northwest. We will curate specific displays to a community or a certain demographic or something that they're trying to do, or it just happens to be geographic. It could be in Minnesota, you know, that just quilt blocks from there. The other side of it is, let's continue to make quilt panels, because we continue to get about one or two every single week that continue to come in.
Wow. And I know, although I haven't done it very much yet, that via your website, it is possible to actually view much, perhaps all of the quilt, and to even search the quilt.
Yeah.
It's kind of extraordinary to me. Can you just say a quick word about how that works?
Yeah, so we launched last year, a project had taken place when the quilt was in Atlanta under the leadership of Julie Rode and others, a project with the University of Texas, Dallas, where they designed and they digitized and digitally stitched the entire quilt together in very high res. And so you can actually go to our website, again, aidsmemorial.org, and you can go search the quilt. And as an example, you can go in and you can type in the name Ryan White. And what will happen is you'll see the hundreds of quilt blocks that were brought up, that were made in Ryan's honor, and it'll have a little red ribbon, and you'll see the 50,000 blocks, panels that are there, the 6,000 individual blocks that are all stitched together. It's really powerful. And then you can click in, you can go right to the block and you can see it and bring it right up there. The other thing is that it gives the people the opportunity to find a loved one, to look at a panel that they may not have seen since they made it maybe 20 years, 25 years ago.
And again, aidsmemorial.org is the website where people can go and learn much more, not only about the quilt, but also about the Memorial Grove and all of the other good work done by the National AIDS Memorial. And it's Chief Executive John Cunningham. Mr. Cunningham, thank you so much for being part of the morning show today. And thank you for all of the good work that you and your colleagues are doing on behalf of the National AIDS Memorial.
Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Dr. Art Sear joins us, for his monthly visit to the program to offer his analysis of current events and issues. On Thursday's morning show, Scott Ryan, the author of a book called Moonlighting, An Oral History, looking back at one of the most groundbreaking and influential programs in television history. And on Friday, the Bronx Zoom, a look at the New York Yankees and their season during